Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I'm Allison Sweeney, and I will be hosting the Undisclosed Addenda for the Joseph Webster series. I'm executive producing and starring in a murder mystery series for the Hallmark Movies and Mysteries channel about a podcaster who solves crimes in real life. So it's a little art imitating life, imitating art, or is it the other way around? Life imitating art, imitating life. Anyway. In this first episode of the Joseph Webster series, the Undisclosed team took us back to Nashville in 1998 and the murder of Leroy Owens. And while Joseph Webster is in prison for that murder, the first episode raised serious questions about whether that murder was actually committed by his half-brother, Kenny Neal. Today, I'm joined by three fantastic Undisclosed regulars. And the guests are Amelia McDonald Perry. She's a writer and reporter and editor with nearly 20 years experience in media. She writes about pop culture, true crime, and the justice system for outlets like RollingStone.com and The Appeal. And she's co-hosted Undisclosed Freddie Gray's series. Before flying solo on a recent Keith Davis Jr. arc, Amelia, we are all so grateful to you for covering the Keith Davis Jr. case. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. I mean, you did an amazing, amazing job with that. And everyone else who feels the same way I do can follow her on Twitter at XO Amelia.
Thank you.
If you don't feel the same way, then don't.
You'll be getting into it. It'd be a bad idea for you.
Yeah. Don't do it. Her DMs are always open. I like that. Celeste Trustee is an advocate for the wrongfully convicted and criminal justice reform and recently joined the team at FAMM as the Pennsylvania State Policy Director, helping families with loved ones serving mandatory minimum sentences share their stories. Colin Miller is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. All right, guys, welcome. This is such an interesting case, Colin, but before we get into it, I want to talk to Amelia about the Keith Davis Jr. trial that I don't even know what to say about the outcome of that trial last Friday. Like, I can't even say the words.
Yeah.
It's just so incredible. I don't know if having like a week pass by since the verdict, how are Keith and his family doing? I mean,
you know, I think that they have, you know, Keith and Kelly have been through this so many times, frankly, that I think to a certain degree, they both were kind of prepared for the worst because that's kind of the only way you can kind of get through this kind of situation. That said, you know, this trial was odd. Like, I really believe that the defense had the strongest case they've ever had, and even stronger than what was presented in court. And the state had by far the weakest case they've ever had. So to have it go the way it did, you know, the jury spent altogether less than, you know, a day deliberating. And it was a 2-week trial. And I have to say, when I'd finished recording the last episode at like 6 a.m. or something, as was typical for me during this entire series. I was like, I'm going to take a little nap because I figured that they wouldn't be back with the verdict by then. And I slept for a little while and I was woken up by Keith's attorney saying verdict's in. I literally like flew into an Uber and I got there and, you know, just in time to hear what happened. And I was so disoriented and I honestly had a complete
seemed like a nightmare.
Attack. Yeah. It was awful. I mean, I really thought that it was probably going to be another hung jury.
Right.
Which is just awful too, because it's a continuation of like the expectation at this point is that Marilyn Mosby would keep trying him. So that was going to be terrible. I never in my wildest dreams did I think that the jury would vote him guilty though. And I really think, you know, I've thought so much about this. And we all have. And I think what we're kind of coming up with is that, you know, obviously we can't talk to the jury, but the closing arguments from the state were some of the wildest, most egregious, disgusting closing arguments I've ever heard. I can't imagine they will stand up on any sort of appeal. And altogether, I think the hope is that there were so many violations throughout that closing argument from them that perhaps prayers that the judge will agree to give him a new trial. We don't know, though, but there is a motion for a new trial that's going to be filed. I think it has to be filed by sometime next week. And I can imagine, though I don't know for sure, but I can imagine that the arguments that are going to be made in that are going to largely focus on, I think, the closing arguments from the state. I mean, there were so many outright lies, like, not like, I'm going to misconstrue some stuff and, you know, misrepresent it to the jury, like outright lies. Like the state's attorney, the assistant state's attorney, literally fabricated an entire concept of DNA science.
Colin, talk to us about, like, does that happen all the time and we're just now becoming aware of it? I mean, I feel like it's one thing when you make an opening statement and then you never actually prove the thing that you mentioned in your opening statement, but to do it in a closing statement seems so much more egregious. Like, we didn't hear any of those things in this trial. How are they allowed to say that?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'll have to consult with Keith's team, because the key Maryland case on this is actually a case that involved Thera Vignaraja, who of course is the prosecutor on the appeal for Adnan. Yeah, and it was a case in closing arguments where he was talking about the DNA evidence and the blood evidence in a vehicle and just completely misrepresented what that evidence could and could not show. And that led to a new trial. So I think from my listening to the series and what went on during closing arguments, that case could be the strongest case for winning a motion for a new trial.
Yeah, I would love to know, you know, a little bit more about that. Maybe we can talk a little bit after we're done recording, because I know that right now, like, Keith's support team is hard at work, like, reading all sorts of case law for the many, many things that we know were untrue in that closing. But a big thing I noticed right away was the DNA. And, like, I mean, no DNA evidence was actually used in the case. And the state ran with this idea of sort of explaining why no DNA was used, because, you know, there wouldn't have been any DNA connection between Kevin Jones and Keith Davis Jr., because Keith's blood, after he got shot, would have fallen on top of Kevin's blood and masked it, which is literally not real. That's not a real thing. Right. There were so many examples of things like that, where he was either misconstruing the evidence or talking about things that weren't in evidence, either and largely, you know, in a misrepresentative fashion, that it was almost like the totality of all of it. I don't know how the state could possibly believe that this verdict would stand. So,
yeah, the case is the Derek Toomer case. I blogged about it. This was on April 5th, 2016. It's Derek Toomer, and it involved actually pretty similar misstatements of fact and closing statements. So that'd be a good case for them to cite in the motion for a new trial.
Interesting. You know, I was thinking to myself, I bet Patrick Seidel and Thera Vignaraja are friends. And now this makes me think that maybe they consulted with Thera.
Well, it just goes to show, I think, one thing that's hard for us when we're listening to this, any of these podcasts, and you guys fill us in with so much important information and so many of the details, and you really, like, fill in all the blanks, that it's sort of hard to put yourself in the shoes of the jury who isn't sometimes getting maybe even half of that information. And if they are, it's often in a really hard to understand way. And are you writing notes? And do you remember that? And then one strong man, as we've discussed in previous cases, like, one strong personality in that jury room can really sway it one way or the other and make a really big decision, you know.
Yeah,
easier. And I feel like that's sometimes hard to wrap your head around when you're listening to all the facts, that they didn't get all the facts, right? I mean, I think you mentioned that in the closing, in your closing episode, like, they didn't hear what we heard.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot they didn't hear. I mean, this case, it's hard to, you know, there's been so many trials, and in each trial, there's been new kind of things coming out. Usually it's the defense learning new information about the police investigation.
Right.
I mean, this case there was so much Brady material that was withheld from the defense until actual trial. And, you know, for some reason in Maryland, like if the prosecution finally turns over Brady material with like a gun to their head, that's still considered meeting, you know, that's then they're not under violation. Like, and everything's fine. Yeah, it's really crazy. That's something I've heard from a lot of attorneys in Baltimore specifically, that the judges are really, really hesitant to declare a mistrial or to throw out charges, even when there are several, you know, cases of Brady material being withheld to the very, very last minute. And that often the remedy is either, oh, we'll postpone the trial, which sucks for the defendant who's probably incarcerated while awaiting trial. Yeah. Or, and it's not really a remedy. And it's certainly not a slap on the wrist of any meaningful sort for the state. And so as a result, you never, the state never changes its behavior. It continues to do this. So it's really infuriating. You know, we have hope. I know that this is an awful time for Kelly and Keith. And, you know, Kelly is continuing to fight because she's just the most incredible person. And everybody who supports them will be behind them for as long as they want us. So there you go.
We gotta keep hoping for that.
One of the biggest struggles in our house right now, or really at any given time, is dealing with kids and technology and limiting their screen time. Because look, you know what? You gotta struggle to make sure the 5 more minutes doesn't end up being 5 more hours. Well, with Circle, you can set limits and end the screen time debate with your kids once and for all. Kids already face a million distractions online. You know, there's Fortnite, Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, the list goes on. So many apps, I don't even know about them. But Circle makes it easy to take childhood offline when needed so they can focus on homework, chores, bedtime, or just spending time with you. Circle also makes sure your kids are not buying apps that they shouldn't, or they're not signing up for social networks that they're too young for. Because with Circle, you can rest easy knowing they're safe inside the guidelines that you set. Circle is the easiest way to manage your family's online time across all their connected devices, inside and outside your home. You can filter what content is allowed, set limits for the screen time, monitor history and usage. And every single family member has a profile that's totally customizable to their needs, their age, and maturity. Look, we'll never stop worrying about our kids, but with Circle, you'll have one less thing to worry about. Right now, our listeners get a limited time offer of $30 off a Circle Home Plus when you visit meetcircle.com/undisclosed and enter undisclosed at checkout. This is a limited time podcast exclusive offer. That's meetcircle.com/undisclosed, and don't forget to enter undisclosed at checkout to save $30.
And on the flip side of this entire process, Celeste, we are talking about Chester Holman III, who is your friend,
yes.
Right? And is a case that was covered on a previous season of Undisclosed. And on July 15th, the judge set him free. Mm. I mean, that it's so incredible. And these prosecutors actually agreed, right? They said mm-hmm. that he was likely innocent of the 1991 murder of Tae Jung Ho.
Right.
And on July 30th, they dropped all charges. I mean, what an incredible turnaround. I find, how's he doing? How's his family?
So they're doing incredibly well. Yeah, this was kind of a shock for all of us. We all knew that he would be coming home. You know, everybody had been working with the Conviction Integrity Unit on this for a while, so we knew the state was with us. They were filing joint stipulations and things like that. So we definitely had a feeling that eventually he would come home. But nobody knew on July 15th there was a court date, and everybody was kind of expecting it to be a status hearing. And Chester wasn't even brought down. Nobody expected this to happen. And all of a sudden, Judge Bright just said she demanded his release right away. And so I actually wasn't even in the courtroom that day because I was prepping for a big event that I had for work that night. And I got a phone call from Chester's attorney, Alan Tauber, and he said, hey, are you sitting down? And usually for me, that's a bad call, right?
Right.
And so I sat down and he's like, Chester's coming home tomorrow. And I lost it. I mean,
I haven't cried like that in a long time. And so we talked about it. And then I called Rabia and I was like, hey, are you sitting down? And, you know, we just started crying.
Wow.
And then I got a phone call from Alan again saying, yo, they're letting him go tonight. So I talked to Chester that morning. He woke up and planned his day out like a regular day in prison, like every day before that for the last 28 years. He was at work in the gym. And he got a phone call and said, hey, you need to go to your counselor's office. And this just happened so quickly. They said, technically, you're a civilian now. You need to get out.
Wow. And so,
and, you know, his prison was about 2.5-3 hours away from home. And so his family was scrambling to get there. His attorney was scrambling to get there. But everybody got there. I wasn't able to be there because I was, again, hosting this big event that night. But I met up with him the next morning and took him and his family out for breakfast. And, you know, it was just, it's still surreal. It's still surreal to be able to text him and get these, you know, phone calls from him and be able to call him back if I need to, as opposed to waiting for him to call me back or hearing every 5 minutes that this is you're getting a call from an inmate at, you know, this prison. And so it's really just, it's been beautiful. And his first 2 weeks home, he actually rescued a puppy from one of the puppy programs up at his prison. So his, and he, yes, I know. And so he named the puppy Journey. And so, you know, he was talking to me about the dog keeps eating grass and how do you stop the dog from eating grass and just little things like that are just so precious that all those things were stolen from him for so long, you know, and then being in the courtroom yesterday to actually witness his full exoneration was incredible. Of course, I was weeping the whole time, the entire time, and hearing Patricia Cummings from the Conviction Integrity Unit, she was incredible. And, you know, in my history of working in criminal justice reform, I am not very fond usually of district attorney's offices. It's something that, especially in Philadelphia, we are just so used to them fighting against any sort of justice. Yet watching Patricia lay out the facts of the case, lay out the fact that Chester is innocent and that the Commonwealth failed him, and not just failed him accidentally, they intentionally failed him for the last 28 years by withholding information that if presented to the defense before trial, Chester would not have been convicted. In the homicide file, there was an anonymous tip that was called in less than 24 hours after the crime that led to the alternate suspect that we had already suspected was the alternate suspect. And if they, and there was actually an investigation by the police into that person and into that group of people. However, once they were unable to actually match that somehow with Chester Holman and Deirdre Jones, they dropped the investigation. Because if you already have a coerced confession from Deirdre Jones, how are you then going to go to court, you know, with this other information saying, you know, these people actually probably did it and here's why, but we also have this confession from Deirdre Jones, but there's no way to connect those people to Chester Holman. And so it really was amazing watching Patricia Cummings lay this out before the judge. And this was before Judge Bright, who has ruled against Chester in the past. And, you know, but she also didn't have all of the information that the Commonwealth did have, because up until, I believe it was May of 2018, nobody besides the original police, you know, and the original prosecutor had seen this information. And so whenever the Conviction Integrity Unit accepted this request, they gave full disclosure, and we were immediately able to figure out that, prove even just further that Chester was railroaded, and there was Brady information that had been covered up for 28 years that would have resulted in Chester never being put in prison.
Colin, I feel like this Patricia Cummings deserves, you know, real recognition for stepping forward and doing the right thing, because we've come across a lot of people who are willing to like die on their stand of guilty. But it sounds like Undisclosed has gotten 3 overturned cases in Philadelphia, right? I mean, was Patricia part of all 3 of those?
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is something we recognized in talking with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, is that they're doing something good here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. There's so much red tape and bureaucracy and inertia that's connected with wrongful convictions. And we just saw Larry Krasner coming in and wanting to do the right thing. And so Sean Thomas, Terrence Lewis, and Chester Holman have now all been exonerated. The fourth person is Willie Vesey. We continue to work with the CIU and Patricia Cummings on his case. And I'm hopeful that in the next few weeks or a couple of months, we'll have a resolution in his case as well. So absolutely. If you look across the country, we'll cover this in episode 3 of this series. There are so many conviction integrity units that are what we call CIUs in name only. They don't actually exonerate people. They're just there sort of to placate the public. In right. Philadelphia, they're doing it the right way. This is the 8th exoneration under Larry Krasner, and I think that more are going to be coming in the next few months.
Actually, there was a 9th this morning. A 9th.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. It was another case, it was John Miller, and it was a 1996 homicide. And, you know, again, the same exact time period as we saw with Chester Holman, Jimmy Dennis, Sean Thomas, Terrence Lewis, all of these people. Today there was the 9th exoneration under Larry Krasner. So it really wow. is incredible. And there was a conviction integrity unit in Philadelphia under former district attorneys here in Philadelphia. But again, like Colin said, they were in name only. They did not really do much work to actually try to seek justice in these cases.
And I remember when we first started talking about the first Philadelphia case, maybe Colin, you discussed that Pennsylvania has really strict laws in favor of the prosecution, right? I mean, in general, they were a very conviction strong state. So maybe that's part of what's making these so many easy to overturn.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a common trait we see between the Chester Holman case and the Joseph Webster case that we're covering here out of Nashville. And that is really all courts, but especially Pennsylvania courts, make it really difficult to overturn a conviction based upon a key witness recanting. That's why for so many years, Chester Holman, despite recantations, was not able to get out. But when you cut again past the red tape and you say it's not about a court of law applying this strict legal standard, it's about people looking at this evidence
yes.
and seeing
mm-hmm. right.
how this case has fallen apart. They can see what happened and they can throw it out. These judges are sort of bound by these strict legal standards. Yeah, in Pennsylvania, Ali, as you know, is so restrictive and makes it so difficult at a court level to have these convictions thrown out.
That's
right.
What's so frustrating, I think, about the Keith case is knowing, like, you sitting in court so many times, and especially this last trial, and seeing so much come out that further mm-hmm. calls into question. Like, we literally were, the defense presented evidence that the lead homicide detective deleted messages and photos from Keith's phone around the time of the murder. And that was just sort of shrugged at. Like, the judge didn't really do anything about it. And then the prosecutors ended up not calling that homicide detective to testify, but they moved forward with the case. And of course, the jury heard none of this. And it's like tremendously gaslighting to feel
right.
like you're listening to what it just amounts to, having no reason to trust mm-hmm. in the integrity of an investigation. And then just seeing a prosecutor continue forward with it as if what we just witnessed didn't happen is mm-hmm. crazy. It's incredibly maddening because, yeah, it does come down to, you know, Marilyn Mosby could stop this now, but
right.
she won't.
Yeah.
Is there a CIU unit involved in the Joseph Webster case, Colin?
Yeah, there is. And this is sort of similar to what we saw in Philadelphia. As Celeste notes, there was a CIU before Larry Krasner took over, but it really lacked any teeth. Nashville recently has started a CIU. They've actually reached out and talked to Patricia Cummings in Philadelphia to see how they've run things. And so they're sort of at the ground level. They are in the latter stages of reviewing the Joseph Webster case. And we're hopeful that in the next month or two, they're going to have a ruling in Joseph's case. And of course, we're hoping it's a positive ruling.
You bring up a great point that when you see prosecutors lying over and over and over, and people know they're lying, but there's absolutely no recourse for it. And we see that with the prosecutor of Chester Holman, who also prosecuted Jimmy Dennis, who was recently released after 25 and a half years innocent on death row. Also a recent exoneration of Orlando Maisonette, which was another Roger King wrongful conviction that was sent to death row. We see over and over that he was able to get away with lying and completely fabricating all of these things, holding people's records against them to get them to try to testify. He actually, at one point, Roger King said to Chester Holman's family, somebody said to Roger King, well, you know, what if we can prove that Chester didn't do this? And he said, well, my job isn't to prove that. My job is to get a conviction.
And so that's insane.
When you have that type of person, and he, I believe, was an ADA in Philadelphia for 31 years. So imagine in the culture of being, you know, in under Lynn Abraham, who was really the most deadly district attorney, basically, in America, right? And to have that culture, and then to have the culture of, you know, we have these tapes where people are being trained as ADAs on how to strike Black people from juries without getting called on that, without getting in trouble, without being able to raise a Batson claim. This is the culture that all these people were convicted in. You know, when you have people who don't have a lot of money or don't have a lot of, you know, time in the legal system or experience in the legal system, you can see people getting railroaded, but you know that the prosecutors are never going to get in trouble for it. And when we see this pattern, we have to do something about it.
Like, you talk about justice reform. I mean, if there was one thing that we could really change in our system that would make a long-term benefit for everybody, mm-hmm. would be if it was fair. If there was, there's clear consequences for defense attorneys.
Right.
There's a clear remedy when the defense attorney does something wrong. Mm-hmm. And somehow the prosecutors and, frankly, judges are somehow, like, protected from that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. it just seems such a flaw in the system. And I'm not sure where it comes from in our history. Like, maybe along the way, there was a belief that they really were just trying to do the right thing. But that's so clearly not what's happening now.
And many judges are former prosecutors. So funny how that happens.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if the district attorney's office is supposed to, you know, really look at public safety and justice as their overarching goal, how is it helping public safety when you are intentionally convicting the wrong people of homicide, especially when you know the correct people who did it? You know, it just seems like it's such the opposite of what a prosecutor's office is supposed to be doing. And, you know, when you look at Chester Holman's case, Tae Jong Ho was murdered, and he...
Right.
You know, none of the things that the prosecutors or the police have done in the last 28 years did anything to honor his memory or did anything to serve in justice for that victim and his family.
Yeah, that's one of the, it's so cruel too, you know, because it, what you see happening is the prosecution often sort of pitting against each other, like, you know, supporters of the person who is charged with the murder against the family of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, justice, right. as far as we're concerned, justice for Kevin Jones starts with justice for Keith Davis Jr. Like, you can't, Keith did not murder Kevin Jones.
Right.
And him serving time in prison, being convicted of that crime, doesn't do any service to Kevin Jones. It doesn't, mm-hmm. That's not honoring his memory at all. And I mean, and it's tragic that his family has apparently been sort of, you know, they seem to believe what they've been told by the prosecution, but you know,
of course they want to believe it. I mean,
yeah,
if you are the victim and you're in your victim's family and you're in this emotional state, you are looking to someone, obviously, like,
yeah,
you know, the person with the badge, the person on who's supposed to be on your side to give you answers. And then they show up with like all these confident things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're going to believe them. And a few families sort of really sort of see through that, the smoke and mirrors, but not always. I mean, of course, like, I have such sympathy for them.
Totally.
Right.
The desire for closure makes sense. You know, like,
you make such a good point that like there is someone out there who really killed them. And,
right.
and it's true in poor Heyman Lee's case and mm-hmm. on forward, right? Like, someone really did it. And then that person, God forbid, is out there able to do it again. And you look at like, well, I guess, you know, we have a pretty good suspicion here that Kenny Neal has a lot, but like, what did he go on to do with
right.
his freedom? You know, what crimes do we think he could be out there doing that we don't know anything about, because no one did anything. No one put him away.
And if they're just out living their lives, that's fine as well. But the point is, there is so much tragedy and devastation when you
right.
intentionally convict the wrong person. And you see it over right. and over. You're seeing it in the Joseph Webster case. You're seeing it in all these different cases where we know that person didn't do it, but
right.
but the prosecution is intentionally refusing to give any leeway or face the facts. And that is just not serving justice in any way.
And I hate to bring it up to make it this point too, but there's a In the Dark case about this as well. Like, how many times are you going to retry someone when your case keeps getting overturned, how expensive is that for the cities that we're talking about, and money and time and effort, where like there's other real crimes going on or other things that you need to be addressing, and you're taking the taxpayers' money and wasting it on a fifth trial now.
And then the human cost also. I mean, when you think about Curtis Flowers being innocent on death row, I mean, being innocent in general population is hard enough, but then being innocent on death row, you know, I know in Pennsylvania,
knowing the call could happen at any
point. At any point in time, you know, in Pennsylvania, they're in solitary confinement, you know, that is torture. And so we are torturing an innocent human being. I don't think it's right to torture even a guilty human being, but to torture an innocent human being, the human cost of that on him and his family is just, we can't even quantify that.
One of the things we've talked a lot about in Keith's case is the fact that, you know, clearly, well, they took the state, you know, there was the initial armed robbery trial, and then the what was now four murder trials for this one murder. And, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is how, to a certain degree, like they would have kept trying Keith until they got a conviction, but a lot of it was also about just wearing him out.
Right.
Where, you know, hoping that his family would reach a point where literally financially they just could not make it work anymore. I mean, his team has raised money so far to help pay for prior attorneys. Right now he's represented by the public defender's office, but, you know, Kelly has four kids that she's raising on her own and trying to sustain, you know, fighting for him. And we really think it's about like wearing down their resources. So he literally can't defend himself anymore.
Just for the W, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Just for conviction rates. I mean, I'll talk about Roger King again. When he retired, he got accolades, you know, he got all these wonderful articles written about him, you know, the best of the best, because he had so many W's, he had so many convictions. However, you know, so many of them are wrongful. And even the people who aren't innocent that might have actually offended and been prosecuted by Roger King, how many of them were over-sentenced because of his tactics? You know,
There's statistics in Philadelphia, right? That didn't Larry Krasner come up with statistics that say 72% of the death row sentences in Philadelphia over the past 40 years have been overturned?
Yes.
72%?
Oh my God.
So, and we're thinking about this. I mean, 72%. So if you had a failure rate of 72% in airlines, right?
No one would fly.
If you had an error rate in Fords of 72%, like people wouldn't drive Fords anymore. But we can just look at a person, you know, and sentence them, either whether they're innocent or guilty. If they are guilty, we're sentencing them based on a snapshot of the worst day of their lives and saying, first of all, now you deserve to be tortured for God knows how long based on this, you know? And also, there's no way you'll ever, ever be able to rehabilitate yourself and be an upstanding member of society, which flies in the face of science, first of all, and also humanity. But just the fact that now we right now in Pennsylvania have a moratorium on the death penalty. We're not actually executing anybody, but that's based on our governor. That could change at any minute. We saw in the last governor election last year here that the Republican challenger said he would reinstate the death penalty immediately. And I thought, well, no, you won't, because I'll fight you about it if I have to. But this is, 72% out of Philadelphia have been overturned. It just speaks to the culture of absolute draconian, punitive, you know, politics that has been in Philadelphia for so long until very recently.
There's a case you were mentioning to Colin, the Ralph Trent Stokes case. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so he's a real good friend of mine, and he's been in prison since 1982. There was a triple homicide in West Philadelphia in 1982. A mailman was murdered, as well as two other folks who worked there at the restaurant. So it became a really big case because the restaurant had been co-owned by Joe Frazier, the boxer, and because the feds got involved because, again, a U.S. mail carrier was murdered. And so he was convicted and sent to death row in 87. And so he has been in prison since 1982 and on death row since 1987. And the interesting thing is, whenever I was advocating for Jimmy Dennis, who was on the same death row as Ralph, when I would talk to Jimmy, he said, you know, sis, I am not the only innocent person on this row. And I thought, really? He said, and I'm not the only innocent person on this row from Philadelphia. And I'm not the only innocent person on this row who was convicted by Roger King. And I thought, tell me more, because at that point I already had known about Roger King and his awful tactics. And he said, look, you need to fight for Ralph Trent Stokes. I have been on this row with him for, at that point, it had been 20 years. This man is innocent. He needs to come home, and nobody's listening to him. And so he has had his death warrant signed multiple times. He is still fighting, and he is still innocent. And Roger King, you know, he was able to, in the trial, you know, talk about evidence that didn't even exist. He said that there was evidence of a mixture of barbecue sauce and blood in some of Ralph's shoes. First of all, they weren't even Ralph's shoes. They were Ralph's brother's shoes that he was cleaning just because he was a shoe freak and liked to clean his shoes. And there was not barbecue sauce or blood mixture in that liquid that they were using to clean the shoes or on the shoes. But he was able to talk about that during the trial as if it was real evidence. And so I forget who was mentioning earlier, juries are given information, but not always armed with facts. And so when you have the district attorney, who is a renowned district attorney, the ADA prosecutor, who is going around, he had this like Southern Baptist preacher essence about him. You know, he used Bible verses whenever he was prosecuting people. And, you know, he was very convincing. And if you have somebody like that talking about, wow, this guy right here shot and killed three people in this brazen robbery and blah, 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 and there was barbecue sauce and blood on his shoes, well, what is the jury going to think, right? That's exactly what happened here. Ralph did not do this. Ralph did not do this, yet he is sitting on death row since now 1987, but in prison since 1982 for a crime he didn't commit. We see over and over all of these exonerations of Roger King's prosecutions, his quote unquote victories, that are all shaky. And my hope is that as we see more and more exonerations under Roger King, that Ralph's case, Isaiah Givens' case, so many other cases of you know, who people who have valid innocence claims, valid claims of wrongful conviction, that their cases will also be overturned. I would love to see a mass exoneration of Roger King's convictions, because if we have seen this, we have already seen, now I believe it is three or four exonerations from death row.
That's crazy.
From Roger King, right? That is how many people, again, the wrong people were convicted. So how many victims, in Ralph's case alone, there are three victims, you know, who that third person, if there was a third person involved, was not Ralph. You know, when you think about Jimmy Dennis, you know, there was a 17-year-old woman who was shot and killed in broad daylight, and the prosecutors and police did not care who actually did it. They just wanted it to look like they got a conviction. And so the more that we see this, this is an actual pattern. It's not just me going off being a raving lunatic about Roger King and also wrongful convictions in general. These are patterns. And if we can see that this is a pattern of injustice, we have a moral and ethical obligation to do something about it.
You know, I have been talking to Celeste about this. She sent me the files. I'm in the early stages of reviewing. I'll get to them in more depth after this current Joseph Webster series. But yeah, I mean, Larry Krasner asked how many innocent men are still in death row in Pennsylvania. And it's my firm hope that we can investigate this case, present it undisclosed, work with the CIU again, and that hopefully one day Ralph Trent Stokes will be walking out of the prison cell just like Chester Holman did.
Yeah. And when you want to, I mean, obviously I'm focused on the fact that he was wrongfully convicted, and it's just such a grave injustice that he has been tortured for this many years on death row being wrongfully convicted. But again, the human cost, we have to look at this. Ralph right now is 7 hours away from his family in Philadelphia. He is across the state, clear across the state at SCI Green. His mother is in hospice care.
Yeah.
She can't go visit him. Right. So he can't talk to his mother. He can't see his mother. He lost two brothers tragically while he was there. He can't go to those funerals. He has to mourn alone in solitary confinement about all of these losses. You know, family members drop off, friends drop off after a while. People, it's hard. I mean, it's difficult for me to even get out to visit him, you know, being 6 hours away from him, but it's awful that we are putting people in a position that they are losing family support, that they're losing support from the community based on where we're housing people, but also the fact that we have now told the community that this person murdered three people when he didn't do it.
Right.
Meanwhile, Jeffrey Epstein gets to go home every day.
So true, though. It's awful.
Right. I mean, free to go molest other little girls. All right. But one of the other really important elements of all of these cases, I think one of the things that they all have in common that I find incredibly fascinating is that there are people on death row. And actually, I think that both Chester Holman, right, and Joseph Webster have this in common, not to mention a bunch of other cases, but where it was a witness for the prosecution who gets up there and speaks, you know, and then recants, often like right away recants. Mm-hmm. And yet that doesn't seem to hold any weight with the judge. If you think they're lying now, how can you hold their first version or some version in the middle in the Adnan case, you know, like some random version that came along at some point as the one that's the truth and that one can convict when all the rest of the versions before and after you decide are the untruthful ones? Colin, I don't understand the logic from a judge's perspective.
This gets back to that legal inertia that we talk about in the system. And it's sort of this concern that judges have where if we allow this recantation to lead to an exoneration, that's going to open the floodgates to defendants' families reaching out and bribing or coercing witnesses for the prosecution to recant. And it's this concern of a slippery slope that I don't really think would exist. You know, you can kind of get a sense when a person is talking whether they've been pressured into that statement or not. Mm-hmm. And in both Chester's case and Joseph's case, this seems pretty genuine, the person recanting. And yeah, I mean, Ali, as you know, to the extent you're looking at them and saying, I really can't trust this recantation, if that is the witness or one of the key witnesses who put this person away for life or put them on death row, how can you still trust that conviction if you're not trusting them now?
Right. Yeah.
And in the Holman case, there were two witnesses that testified for the prosecution that said that Chester did it. One was Deirdre Jones, who said she was with him at the time. She was 19 years old, single mother of two. They said that Chester was in the junior black mafia and he was going to go have her murdered, and that they were threatening to take her kids away, threatening to charge her with the murder, which would then take her kids and put them in foster care. At 19, you know, imagine that pressure.
Right.
Right. And then you also have the other person who recanted, the only other witness who actually placed Chester there, Andre Dawkins, who had a rap sheet as long as, you know, a CVS receipt. And basically, and one of those convictions is actually for making false statements against somebody else. Right. And he had multiple aliases that had, you know, rap sheets attached to them. And in his recantation, which was videotaped, Andre Dawkins even said, the prosecutor, the police, they came to me and said, basically, if you don't cooperate with us, you know what you have to say, because otherwise, look at all these charges we have. Look at all these things. And so what is someone going to do when they are facing charges for all kinds of different things, right? Maybe open warrants, or if they're threatening you with kids, taking your kids away, they're threatening you with the death chamber. What else are you going to do, right? So many people give false statements. But in Chester's case, both of those witnesses recanted. Both of those times they tried to go into court, and both of those times those recantations were denied. And I understand, again, if the judge had all of the information, if that Brady information had been given to her from the beginning or even before the recantations were submitted, perhaps she would have been able to rule differently. But as Colin said, it is so difficult to prove innocence in a court of law, especially in Pennsylvania, because there are just so many things that are in the way.
So, Colin, I understand that you're working on a project that's connected to the Keith Davis Jr. case?
Yeah, it's sort of loosely connected in a sense. There's this interesting / disturbing line of cases out there that deals with the Fourth Amendment. And so I'm working on an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief for law professors to the Supreme Court. This was a police shooting in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They were going to arrest a suspect.
The fourth, just for everyone, the Fourth Amendment is search and seizure. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, search and seizure. And that's the key question, Ali, is the question of seizure. they came to arrest one woman. A second woman was driving away and the police officer shot her twice, but she was able to drive away. And so in order to bring a claim of excessive force, a civil rights claim against the police, you have to prove that you were seized. There was a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And there's this split among the courts where some courts say, well, if you're shot, of course you were seized. That counts as a seizure and you can bring an excessive force claim. In the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit, where this case was heard, what they hold is, well, no, for a seizure, you actually have to yield to authority. And so if you are shot by police officers and yet still able to escape, that does not count as a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And therefore, you are not entitled to bring an excessive force claim against the police.
What?
That's yeah. And so, crazy. You know, obviously it's not directly the Keith Davis Jr. case, but it is another case of people being shot by police and not having a remedy. Of course, in Keith Davis, it's not only the lack of a remedy, but it's also him being prosecuted rather than actually being offered relief in this case.
What case was that, out of curiosity? That Albuquerque's had a lot of shady police shootings.
Yeah, the case, it's the Roxanne Torres case, and it was decided May 2nd, 2019. So her attorneys are filing a cert petition with the Supreme Court probably by the end of August, and then a bunch of law professors and myself are going to submit this amicus brief probably early October, and hopefully the Supreme Court takes this case. Because otherwise, yeah, you know, we get to the question of what are the deterrent effects of Brady if prosecutors aren't disciplined? Well, if you can't bring an excessive force claim against a police officer who shot someone, there's obviously no deterrent effect to that
no, excessive course, force claim. But does it have to fit into the word seizure? I mean, I would think excessive force is like just as valid on its own. Why does it have to be sort of shoehorned into the word seizure?
See, and Allie, this is whenever you're on the podcast, I always comment how you always have these smart legal thoughts. I have a colleague, Seth Stoughton, who's a former police officer and now a law professor, and he is currently working on a law review article that claims exactly your point, which is to say, why in the world do we require a person claiming excessive force to prove a search or seizure under the Fourth Amendment? Those are entirely distinct concepts, and there's no reason we should require a seizure for a person to claim there was excessive force by police.
That's in general across the country?
That's across the country, absolutely. Wow. Courts differ on what a seizure is, but yeah, every court requires there to be a seizure for there to be a claim of excessive force.
Whoa, I did not know that. That's so, like, for example,
he's absurd
running, the police following him into the garage and shooting him there and taking him into custody. Clearly that they've seized him or whatever. But right. If let's say they shot him and he got away and like, how would that work? Like, if he got away and then later he was at the hospital and that's when they arrested him, that wouldn't count?
Correct. The shooting would not count as a seizure, and he would not, at least in certain circuits, certain jurisdictions, he would not be able to bring a claim of excessive force, even if it were 100% that he was innocent and there was not a basis for shooting at him.
Wow. But I agree. I mean, but like, that's where it gets crazy. Like, I agree. That is not what the word seizure means. Like, you didn't seize him, you didn't have custody of him, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't excessive force. That's a whole separate conversation.
Right.
That so deserves it's like, its own.
Follow that through to its next logical conclusion. It's sort of like, okay, so you police can shoot people, but so long as they don't take them into custody, it's fine. You know what I mean?
Like, it's that's like, the logical conclusion, right?
Yeah. Well, that's concerning.
But beat up, like, shooting maybe isn't even necessarily the only thing, right? Like, yeah. Baton or whatever, like all the other things, as long as you don't grab him, like as long as you don't, is that?
It's absurd. Weird.
It's frustrating because I feel the lack of clarity is dangerous and jeopardizing for everybody, right? Like, mm-hmm. My husband is a police officer and he is a good cop. And I, for my personal experience, feel like most cops are good cops and good men and women who are trying to do the right thing. And when you don't have clarity of the law, when you don't make it clear so that everyone involved understands what you're supposed to do when a police officer pulls you over, then that's where all this gray area happens, I feel, you know, and it's not fair to anyone involved when it's not.
Well, as we've
seen, you're trying to obfuscate it.
Yeah, and just the way that we, I mean, we've been talking about this the whole episode, you know, that there's no accountability, really. And so it seems as though everything, all the laws and things that are set up like that, it's set up to favor police and favor the prosecutor, favor the state, and not the actual person who might have been harmed by those people.
But actually, like, it favors, as we were saying, the win or individual people who are looking for that. It does not favor justice.
Right.
It doesn't favor people who actually believe in, like, wow, this person's really guilty. I mean, you could sort of argue that guilty people go free all the time under the same set of circumstances, because it doesn't matter, because people aren't paying attention to that. It's not as important as the, you know, people aren't, who really believe in justice, aren't getting the good jobs as a prosecutor, aren't running countries, you know, the city as a prosecuting attorney, because they're like freeing innocent people all the time, you know, like, and that seems wrong too.
Right.
In Baltimore, that's like a huge, it's a great way of manipulating the public, like, where, you know, Baltimore has a really high homicide rate, a lot of shootings, and that is, you know, if we had a prosecutor who was like, real, you know, only bringing extremely strong cases to trial, well, knowing the police department the way I do, they would not be bringing a lot of cases to trial, because a lot of cases are complete garbage. Well, then, you know, for them, that's a political problem, because then suddenly it's like, you know, the state's attorney's office isn't prosecuting criminals, and da 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 da. This is the reason why our murder rate is so high. Like it. You know, the police need to be pressured into doing better investigations and like doing legit police work, and state's attorney's office and district attorney's offices need to be pressured into bringing legit strong cases to trial and going back to police if something that's brought to them is just not up to standards. Like, don't try crap cases.
Right. We're seeing that in Philadelphia right now. You know, there have been a rash of homicides recently in Philadelphia, which we already have a pretty high homicide rate. Immediately, people are like, well, that's because Larry Krasner loves people who commit murder. That's because Larry Krasner doesn't enforce the law. Hold on a minute. First of all, Krasner actually prosecutes more gun cases in the previous administration. So it's just a false narrative. There are apparently, now I haven't seen it, but apparently there are billboards that the FOP has taken out on one of our major highways that are talking badly about Larry Krasner. And there was recently just a law passed in the last minute in a back room at the Capitol, basically saying that the attorney general now is going to have jurisdiction or the authority to prosecute gun cases in Philadelphia, and that police officers will be able to go directly to the AG about these cases as opposed to going to Larry Krasner, because the police think that Larry Krasner is way too soft on crime when it's not even close to the case. And you also can't blame a current uptick in homicide on the current district attorney. You have to look at long-term trends here, but they're using this narrative to try to undermine the work that he's doing, which is actually searching for justice.
But it's because he's making them look bad, right? Like, he's new, and they've been there a long time. So of course he's shedding light on previous, you know, techniques. And
it also like comes down to money too, like look, if you really look deeply at what causes crime, like poverty, lack of education, lack of resources, lack of infrastructure, and you actually deal with those problems, like you put city funds into dealing with those problems, you have to take money away from police, which are, look, police cannot solve crime on their own. They can help deal with it, perhaps, but they can't make the things that cause crime go away.
Like,
that needs to be invested in. But then you have less money to give your police department, and there's nothing that a police department wants to lose less than the massive amounts of money that they're given.
However, if we stopped incarcerating people far too long or wrongfully, think about that. Like, think about right now, you know, the amount of money we are, you know, Larry Krasner makes this point that you have to look at, say, it's $42,000 a year baseline to incarcerate somebody in Pennsylvania, right? We are investing that money in incarcerating and incapacitating individuals. Instead of doing that, especially in lower level cases, or when we're sentencing people for far too long based on these awful mandatory minimums, we could be taking that money instead of investing it in incarcerating people. We could invest it in the front end on these exact problems that Amelia is talking about in order to actually reduce those factors, social factors that are criminogenic.
So Celeste, that brings me to ask you, you were recently named the Pennsylvania State Policy Director for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. What kind of work do you do with them?
Yeah, so actually we're no longer Families Against Mandatory Minimums. We're just going as FAM now because we have expanded the amount of work that we're doing. We've been able to see mandatory minimums roll back in a lot of places, and we realize that it's not just about mandatory minimums. It's about sentencing in general and prison reform and criminal justice reform in general. Before I was organizing on the ground for FAM, organizing families and directly impacted folks to go out and try to fight for the change that we need. Now I was just recently promoted to the Pennsylvania State Policy Director for FAM. So now I'm working in Harrisburg directly with legislators, trying to talk to them and educate them on the criminal justice system and how absolutely atrocious Pennsylvania is as far as criminal justice reform. So, you know, we have some great policy initiatives that we're working on this year. We're going to try to look at creating a parole eligibility for people who are sentenced to first and second degree murder after they've served, 25 to 35 years of a sentence. Just parole eligibility, which, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, what do you mean? You want to let Charles Manson out? Hold on. You know, that's the immediately we always get like the worst possible cases. And no, basically, it's just parole eligibility. People can go in front of the parole board, get a hearing. If the parole board believes that they're rehabilitated and can go back into society, then they would be paroled. But that it's not, you know, automatically letting absolutely everybody out. It's just about giving second chances to people who are deserving. We're going to be looking a lot at probation reform, hopefully parole reform, all kinds of different really neat things. And we're doing this awesome initiative right now called the Visit a Prison Challenge. If you're interested, you can go like just look hashtag Visit a Prison. We're actually challenging all lawmakers, policymakers, candidates to actually go inside and visit a prison, because it seems as though so many people who are writing our laws about people who offend and people who are in prison have never actually met someone in prison. They've never actually gone in to a prison and had a conversation with somebody or had a meal with somebody. And once you do that, you realize that people in prison are just like us. We have so much in common with them. And honestly, like, there but for the grace of God go I. Any of them could be on the other side. And so we've noticed that when people do go in and actually take that time to be in community with people in prison, it softens their hearts and lets them realize that, you know what? We all could be where they are, and everybody, mostly everybody, is deserving of at least a second look at their sentencing. So really, we've had a great response. Feel free to tag your lawmakers in that and ask them to participate. We've gotten some great, you know, district attorney candidates from across the country who are participating, some great people in Pennsylvania and a whole bunch of states and at the federal level. And we really think that that could make such a big difference. When we start talking about criminal justice reform, we have to start bringing the humanity into
it. That's right.
You know,
and it's interesting because I think one of the things that you said at the very beginning is encapsulates everything we've been talking about, which is sort of educating people beyond what it seems like the surface level of all of these issues, right? Like,
yeah,
she said he did it. She's
exactly
like, well, and then you have to realize, right? Like, there's so many deeper layers, and people vote on the surface layer, on their gut feeling.
And we call it the CSI effect. You know, it's people watch TV, they watch Law and Order, they watch CSI, they watch all these things, and they think, oh wow, every case is just neatly wrapped up in a bow, and the police get it right, the prosecutors did get it right, everybody's happy. Well, that's just not the case. You know, it's really not the case. In most cases, they're not pretty wrapped up in a bow and everybody's happy at all, you know? And so we really need to start kind of changing the conversation about people who are justice involved, because one in two adults in America knows somebody, you know, in their direct orbit who has justice involvement. But so many people still talk about it as if we're othering those people. Oh, well, you know, that person. Well, you know, if it's normal, we should start talking about it as being normal. And 95% of the people who are in prison are going to come home at some point. So we need to start embracing that concept and also looking at the programming that we're giving people in prison, right? We should understand that prison is about reform too. It's not just about punishing people. We should be trying to restore people to whole so that when they come home, they're able to return to the community and feel like they're a part of their community. They can work, they can have a family if they want, they can contribute in a way. But that's something that we're really lacking here in America. We're just so punitive and then wonder why people recidivate. Well, if you're not giving them programs inside and then we're not giving them supports outside, what are we going to expect? So our role really is to try to educate a lot of people to get out and vote and make sure that the people that you're that you know are representing you in your local or at the state level or at the federal level really understand that these are valid concerns for so many people. Our tax dollars are going to a huge corrections budget. When we know there's not really any a good return on investment after sentencing somebody for a very long time. So that's what I'm trying to do, is just to try to go around and let people know that, you know, we have to be smart about this. It's not about being tough on crime. It's about being smart about our policies so that long term we can have more whole communities.
Celeste, what you say makes a lot of sense, and it's amazing what you are doing. So thank you. And I want to thank all of you for your time. But Amelia, Celeste, before we go, I've kept you here for more than an hour. But before you go, I wanted to give you both a chance if you wanted to talk about Joseph Webster or Kenny Neal or anything about the first episode. You have any questions for Colin?
So no questions yet, personally. But I have to say, I listened to that first episode multiple times because I thought, wait, this can't be real. Wait, what? Wait a minute. You have a brother who the half brother has confessed, and it's still, you know, first of all, I was thinking about as a mother, what that would feel like, you know, but also the fact that this is not the only time it happened. You had Keon come on. I actually texted him afterward, like, hey, I got to hear your voice on the podcast. But this happens, and it just shows how easily, or actually how difficult it is for somebody who there is evidence. Flat out evidence. Somebody else confessed and said this person didn't do it. And we have that in court, yet this person is still in prison. You know,
that was
over and over.
That was the part, first of all, on the undisclosed Instagram account, if you don't, you need to follow it. They posted a side-by-side photo of the two brothers, and you could see how genuinely confusing that would be to identify. I would think you'd really need to do a double take. And if they both weren't in the photo array, like how could you possibly second guess yourself in that moment? But Colin, the question I had about it was exactly the same thing Celeste just said. As a mother, the part of me that thought, I was like screaming at my radio listening to it, like, I don't understand why they waited for the jury to convict before they were like, oh, hey, by the way, he did it. Like, have you not been watching the news? Like, how could you possibly, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but how could you possibly believe in the justice system enough to think like, he didn't do it, he's going to get off? That just, I don't know that adds up for me.
Yeah, it's tough. I just talked to their mother, Marie Burns, yesterday, and she's really broken up about it. It's really so hard for her. I mean, obviously she has one son she thinks is wrongfully in prison. She has another son she thinks committed this murder. And that's a decision she regrets every day, not coming forward at the time of the trial and only coming forward afterwards. And so, yeah, it was a pretty emotional talk with her. I'm going to have some of the audio in episode two, but just a really, really difficult, horrible situation that she has found herself in.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. But not just her. Everyone went along with it and sort of didn't speak up until later. Like the turning point moment of them answering the door to the wrong person, I sort of thought to myself, like, what are you doing sitting on your couch? Like, I don't mean to be just like, I don't understand. Like, get up, answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the thing. Like, a lot of people do believe until they have that experience that the justice system will work. And even in the whole, with the Holmans, they did not think that Chester would be convicted because he did not do it. You know, there was not a ton of evidence. There was no physical evidence that tied him to it. It was just these two shaky, you know, statements. And they thought up until that guilty verdict that he was going to get off.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was really struck by the fact that like in the first episode, I feel like even within the first 15 minutes, like you kind of run through, you know, this case and the conviction and here's this confession from who really did it. And I was like, okay, what's going to happen in the rest of the series? But then I realized, wait a second, that's the point, that like we can know all of this now, and it's still not fixed.
It's still not enough.
Which is terrifying. Yeah. Like, yeah. If somebody just watched somebody get convicted of a crime they did not commit, you know, I'd been thinking for months now that that was my nightmare, was to see that happen, because I know that no matter how innocent Keith may be, this can take so long or not ever happen at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, and now our hope is that please let this be overturned from the motion for a new trial, because even if there's a bazillion issues that I think could win on appeal can take years. That's years inside a place that somebody does not belong, and that is not a good place to be. And it's so just, it's, you know, I worry that the judge will have that kind of reaction where he'll look at all of this stuff and be like, yeah, but this is really more of an issue for an appeal, as if Keith is not a human being sitting in a prison cell. As if this is now just a matter of
procedure. You know,
yes, exactly. I mean, that to me, I get that there are reasons for procedures. At the same time, there is a human cost.
Right.
You know, and at the end of the day, if somebody confesses to a murder somebody else has been convicted of, you know what? Procedure should go out the damned window.
Let them out. Right.
I just don't get it.
You're right. There's so many like sort of really complicated rules, evidentiary rules, where like, you know, whether or not they did it isn't even the question right now. And I, as a sort of common sense person, you find yourself like, I just, this is why I couldn't be a lawyer, because I don't understand how the human element, like, okay, but never mind all the other cases. We're all in this room and we're talking about this guy. Let's talk about this situation and how, like, how is that relevant when here's someone else, you know, like 8 people heard him confess, you know,
and the time bar issue with new evidence, you know, it's like, and we see it, I believe, in this specific case, you know, because the brother confessed before the trial, but nobody came forward. Now it's not new evidence. It's like, but he still confessed and the wrong person's still in prison.
Is there ever a point, Colin, where they can introduce that?
They could file a petition for writ of actual innocence and do it that way. And so that might be a step down the road. But again, the hope would be that the CIU in the next couple months steps in before that's a possibility. But yeah, actual innocence is something, and it's going back to procedure, more complicated than just saying he's actually innocent. That's sort of a gateway to other claims. So it's tough. I mean, it could down the road lead to a court finding him innocent, but that's a lot more difficult than the CIU to saying, we believe now, as Patricia Cummings found in Chester Holman's case, we believe he's innocent, we can send him free.
Right.
So the CIU has an opportunity to sort of circumvent a lot of this stuff. And if we could really support CIUs across the country actually doing the work and actually believing in it, like, that is the remedy, right? Like,
yes.
The right ones.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Okay, well, all right, all of you, we have our cause now. Let's get out there and get those CIUs to really do their jobs. All right, I want to thank all of you so much. This has been a fascinating hour, and I really appreciate all of your time. You guys are fantastic. Keep it up.
Thank you.
All right, thanks so much.
I want to thank our guests, Amelia, Celeste, and Colin. You all are fantastic. Please follow them on Twitter so you can engage with them online. I want to thank all the sponsors of our show. I want to thank Hannah McCarthy, who is our audio producer, and Mithal Tehan, who is the executive producer. Please follow Undisclosed on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Undisclosed. I'm Ali Sweeney. You can follow me at Ali_Sweeney on Twitter or at Ali Sweeney on Instagram. And know that my proceeds from today's episode is going to the Free Adnan Syed campaign. Thank you so much.